All right, welcome back to another episode of Humans Doing Business. And today we have Jeff Davis with Vinylux. And Matt, I thought this is a really cool company. It's someone who has a unique idea. And I thought he had some good tidbits of advice for our listeners. The main thing that stands out to me is he really promotes asking questions and not feeling dumb if you don't know something. And I think that's something that I've struggled with in my life is if there's something I feel like is obvious that I should know the answer to, I'm afraid that I'm going to look stupid and I don't ask questions. So it's always good to hear someone else, you know, speak to that a little bit. And also, I've mentioned before that I really think it's interesting when someone has a failure that they learn from. And the best idea he's ever had was a big flop. So I thought it was pretty interesting, really. What do you think?
Yeah, it was great to hear the story of how it all got started. You know, that it came from a passion for art and design. You know, him being in school and kind of having the flexibility to play with materials and have an abundance of a material that he could use and shape and create products, and it turning into a business idea. And, you know, you don't always hear of entrepreneurs that are really good at design or really good at art and then creating a business that succeeds out of it, because a lot of the times, you know, they're artists, they're designers, they're creators, and that doesn't always equate into good business acumen. And so it's exciting to see someone who has been in the industry a long time, and obviously he's still learning, still growing. But yeah, that was a really fascinating part of the conversation that we had.
All right, and let's hit the intro so that people can hear a voice that's way better than ours.
Yeah, here you go. Here's a smooth talking gentleman.
Welcome to Humans Doing Business, where hosts Matt Browning and Adam Griggs gather amazing stories from leaders in small business. Each episode, our guests will tell you what they're doing that works, what they've tried that failed. But best of all, you'll learn insights to take your business to the next level. Now here's Matt and Adam delivering you another great story.
We are here with Jeff Davis. Jeff, tell us a little bit about yourself and your business.
My business is known as Vinylux, and it is concerned with recycling vintage vinyl, LP, and 45 RPM records. So we collect up about 200 to 250,000 records every year, and we transform them into a line of new products, which include housewares, promotional products, anything from coasters to journals to clocks, framed records, bowls, and all kinds of things.
That's very interesting. What was your inspiration to get started in this business?
So in 2000, I attended the Rhode Island School of Design in the industrial design program to get a master's degree. And I was primarily interested in designing furniture. And I began working with materials that I knew how to use in school. I was using wood and metal. And there was kind of an emphasis in the product design program on understanding plastics because they're used in so many different industries. And as we started getting into kind of simple plastics manufacturing techniques, like just cutting and bending and molding, I struck upon using vinyl records as raw material, as opposed to a sheet of styrene or a sheet of ABS. I was looking at vinyl records both as a raw material that was available to me for not very much money. I was a student and trying to, you know, cobble together my materials as best I could. But also, again, this being the year 2000, the conversation around the idea of sustainability, ecological awareness, recycling was just getting underway, especially in universities. So the idea of the green economy or, you know, green products hadn't really even taken hold in the mainstream yet. But in school, you know, there was required reading, like the book Cradle to Cradle by Paul Hawken. And so in every critique and in every project, there was this kind of added element of, is your product sustainable? Is it ecologically sound? And so this idea of reusing an obsolete material or a product that had outlived its useful first life, could that be transformed into something new, is where the idea of using records came from.
Yeah, and at this time, in 2000, and we'll kind of shape what the landscape looked like in the vinyl industry. I mean, at that point, and you can probably speak to this better than I could, they had totally stopped making vinyl around 2000.
For the most part. I mean, there were some plants still in operation, certainly pressing hip-hop records and dance records, techno records, things that appealed to DJs to utilize in a live environment. Mm-hmm. Were still being put on vinyl, but it was a niche industry. You know, it appealed to collectors who might be looking for rare jazz records or first pressings of, you know, well-known records. But for the most part, when you walked into a vinyl record store, it was a kind of moldy, smelly, dusty old place, usually run by an older guy who had, you know, was a huge music fan and record collector, but a lot of record stores were going out of business.
Sure.
And
they weren't full of young people in those days.
Not at all. I mean, I was definitely, so I was like 27 when I started molding records or doing things with records, you know, from a design standpoint. And I was definitely one of the young guys in the stores. I mean, there were, and I, you know, school, my school is in Providence, which is full of colleges and young people and artists. And there were a couple of cool record stores that sold 10 inches and 7 inches with punk music on it. You know, a lot of bands still like to put songs out on vinyl because it had kind of an edgy quality to it. Mm-hmm. But it was not like it is right now. I mean, sure. Vinyl has seen a massive resurgence in appeal and availability. And, you know, as the years go on, the conversations I have about my product line are with people who are increasingly younger.
Sure.
It was funny at the trade show that I recently did in Chicago, at the end of the show, I had about 8 or 9 young teenagers, like 13, 14, 15 year olds at my booth asking if they could take my product samples home with them. So I gave them all away. And I was sort of touched that it was like these young kids who were attracted to what I was making as opposed to the like 65 year old men that are usually sure. the ones yeah. talking to me about the products. Yeah.
So when you first got introduced to using the plastics as the base of your products, were you pursuing this more as an art expression? Were you pursuing this with the idea that you were going to be creating things for sale? Or, you know, was this hobby? Was this a business pursuit?
Great question. So it was kind of all like, it was all of the above in a way. I had been prototyping a table where the surface of the table was going to be a series of shallow bowls. And the idea was that this was sort of like a potluck dining table. And the bowls were all going to be ceramic and each one containing a different dish that could be shared and exchanged. And as I was prototyping this table, I had made the molds out of plywood on a wood lathe. So I was turning bowls that had these kind of multiple layers in them because of the plies in the wood. And then I was thermoforming black plastic styrene over this plywood form. And the plastic styrene was just sort of an inexpensive way to prototype and figure out proportion and scale and so forth before going to using ceramic or metal for the surface of the table. But as the black plastic formed on these plywood forms, there were concentric rings that were forming in the plastic, like a target. And it really, they looked like records, you know, with the tracks on the records in these concentric rings. And so I was pursuing my degree. I was pursuing kind of an artistic expression. But then when I saw these rings in the black plastic, it also triggered this thought in my head that they looked like records. And I ran out to the Salvation Army and I bought, I don't know, 10, 20 records for like $5. And I brought them back to school and I started experimenting with being able to mold the plastic on the machine that I was using to prototype my table. And, you know, I just threw like a pair of pliers onto the molding bed and I stretched and formed the record over the pliers and it molded them perfectly. And I thought, well, that's really cool because the, you know, this is very good plastic as it had to be to hold the grooves for the audio quality in the vinyl. And the record labels are still intact. And so I just started slumping them under the heat on this machine and it kind of made like a bowl form. And one of my professors came along. I had a lot of freedom to experiment and kind of pursue my own work. There weren't a lot of class assignments. This was a graduate program that was kind of research-based and we were encouraged to pursue our own interests and then present them to a panel of critics, you know, every 4 to 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my professors in this 4 to 4 week interim while I was working said, so what are you up to? And I said, well, you know, I'm trying to figure out if there's like some products I can make out of old records. There's lots of them, like millions, billions of them. And a lot of people aren't really interested in using them anymore. And I'm wondering if I can, you know, turn product A into product B.
I don't think I have the creativity you have.
Say that again. Sorry.
I said, I don't think I have the creativity you have to see something like that and to see it as a piece of art, more or less.
Yeah, well, you know, I was in the right place at the right time. You know, my background that preceded going to graduate school for product design was in theatrical set design. So I went to undergrad and studied theater in a program called the Technical Management track at NYU. And I had a career in theater as a model builder and a draftsman and a set builder and a painter and a props maker. And I worked for about 4 or 5 years in theater and then in film and a little bit in television. And, you know, in theater in particular, you had to be really thrifty. Mm-hmm. The budgets were small, the visions were big, the timelines were short, and it was all about getting it done and making it look good and making it believable. And so kind of transforming an inexpensive material into something that looked solid and believable was a large part of the training and kind of professional pursuit in theater. So it kind of came naturally to me in a way mm-hmm. when I started studying product design to kind of continue that sort of thrifty, repurposed material type of avenue.
Very cool. Kind of thinking about the way that you've learned to monetize this skill that you've got or this big idea that you've had. Am I right in thinking you're e-commerce only or do you have a storefront too?
No, I don't have a storefront. Vinylux started as a wholesale business kind of right off the bat. So again, this being so by the time I had I started school in 2000, like my graduate school, I designed the bowls. The first product I made out of the records was a bowl. And that was in 2002. So the notion of setting up an e-commerce site easily was not really available.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who was an early adopter of computers and technology and knew how to build websites. So he said, you know, why don't I just make you a splash page, which was really just a one-page website that had a picture of the bowls on it, I branded the company Vinylux, and it had an email address and a phone number and not much else on it. But one of the luxuries of having started this business while I was still a student was that I had lots of resources that the school made available, such as I took a class that was geared toward entrepreneurial businesses with a focus on design. So just like I had done, if you had designed a product and you were looking to start a company to support the sale of that product, they brought in intellectual property attorneys to explain to us trademarks and copyright and patent issues.
That's really forward thinking. That's really cool.
It was incredible.
School does that.
It was incredible that RISD, where I was at, had partnered with Bryant College, which is a business school. And they brought in people who understood design and understood business and were providing the support for the students who, you know, maybe didn't want to go work for a large corporation or didn't want to, you know, work for anybody else. And again, this kind of was the beginning of, but in a way preceded what we now understand as the maker movement. This was before Etsy. This was before all of these online marketplaces where you could easily sell your own work. So the early days of my business was very much a DIY venture. I was trying to figure out how to market and sell the product. But again, I had resources at my school. And when I finally came up with this first vessel form, this bowl form that was mass producible and was kind of stable as a product, there are some issues with molding vinyl. It's not all consistent. But when I figured out how to basically take any record and turn it into a bowl, one of my professors said to me, well, now that you have a product, I'd like you to talk to a friend of mine who has a similar business and he makes a decent living doing what he does. He happened to also live in Providence, and he and I became good friends right away. His name is Boris Bally. And Boris is a jeweler who had stumbled upon created for himself making art objects and objects of design out of repurposed highway signs and street signs, like one-way signs and stop signs that he got from like the highway departments. And, you know, again, instead of considering these like scrap metal, he was looking at sort of the beauty of an old used stop sign, but also looking at it as a material like aluminum that could be formed the way aluminum objects are formed.
Okay.
Because he was a trained jeweler and a product designer, he was able to create, you know, really beautiful objects that still had the soul and the recognition of old street signs. And his work was at the Cooper Hewitt Design Museum in New York. He's represented in galleries all over the country. And he just started feeding me information, giving me phone numbers of people to call, connecting me with people in his industry that he thought would provide good support for me.
So it's kind of like a mentor role for you.
He was absolutely a mentor, certainly in the, not so much in the design realm, but in the kind of, all right, you're a designer who doesn't know anything about business, just like me, but your work is cool and your work is tight. And it seems like you've got a good system in place for being able to make lots of these products if you need to. So he shepherded me and mentored me toward how to start a little business.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of the first questions I asked him was, I said, I don't even know what to charge for these things. You know, I paid like 20 cents for the record, and I used the equipment at school to make the molds and to build the equipment I needed to turn this thing into a bowl. And that's just kind of my time. So what would I even charge for these? And he said, well, you know, if you walked into a store, if you walked into the gift shop at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and you saw this thing, and you were charmed by it, and you thought, wow, I really want to own one of those. What would you pay? And I said, I don't know. I'd probably pay $30, $35, something like that. And he said, well, there you go. So you're going to charge 15. There's your price. And he said, because, you know, the margin on this, you can't really do in a typical way. You know, it's not like you're saying, well, there's a $10 cost of goods sold and labor in this thing, and then some packaging costs. So we'll, you know, kind of double the price of that. He said, you know, because you're making this by hand from an inexpensive material, but you're probably the only one in the world doing it, you can kind of charge whatever you want.
Yeah.
And so let's work backwards from there.
And I think this is a great topic for our listeners, you know, how to price an item that you've created. And there are a lot of things that go into that. And we have to be conscious of how we're producing it early on, take into account the equipment and the materials that we get, you know, at a low scale, you know, like you were saying, you were able to get the plastics for dirt cheap, and you were able to use equipment that you were essentially borrowing or that you had access to at that time. But if you scaled the business up, you might not necessarily have that resource to scale, that you might have to get your own equipment. You might have to find a different source for your materials. So I think that being able to look at what your costs might be 2 years down the road or 5 years down the road when you actually have to scale up, you know, that's a challenge for a lot of businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because my situation was sort of unusual because I was in school. In hindsight, you know, I would say, yeah, buddy, but you were paying $25,000 a year to be there, to use that equipment. So yeah. It's not like the equipment was free. I was paying for it in tuition.
Sure.
You know, the bowl, the record bowls still remain a little bit of an outlier, even in my current product line, mainly because they are in a way like a pure expression of reused materials or upcycled materials. There's almost nothing added to the product. So it's a single record that maintains its original 12-inch diameter. I've changed the geometry or the architecture of the flat record into a molded form. And the only thing I add to it is two little 4-inch diameter discs of Mylar to laminate the labels, the original record labels. And just to seal up the little spindle hole in the center. So if someone...
Yeah, I was going to ask about the little spindle hole. It seems like it would be a leak hazard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from the very beginning, I've encouraged people not to necessarily eat out of these bowls.
Yeah, I assume they don't go in the dishwasher.
Yeah. But I mean, if you saw where some of the records came from, you wouldn't necessarily want to put food in them.
Right.
So we've said, you know, treat them like a basket. Use it as a... you know, an art object, or put the mail or your keys in it. It's not, you know, certainly not for eating soup or cereal out of. But I still like to protect the labels with the Mylar. But, you know, kind of getting back to the costing part of it, you know, because there's really no other component parts to that particular product, you know, the margin has remained fairly high, but the manufacturing technique is kind of the expense and the expertise, and is kind of my proprietary system. But every product I've made following the bowls has, you know, the margin has decreased steadily over time because of the need to introduce other materials, other component parts. I think the second or third product I designed using records was a clock, and the clock needed a clock mechanism, like the motor, mm-hmm. and the hands and the hardware to hold it all on. It needed, I was molding the numbers in, but then we switched to a laser cut clock face, which we were then backing with a solid layer of white material so that the numbers were easily readable. And then it needed a box, and then the box had to be printed, and then the box has to be shrink wrapped. And then, because shrink wrap sometimes needs a little hole to let the air out of, then we needed a label to put over the little hole. So suddenly you had like a, you know, a product that has eight component parts in it, whereas the bowl only had one.
I looked at the clock on your website, and it looked really cool.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that was really cool. And honestly, when I looked at the pricing, I thought that's really affordable. If I wanted a Father's Day gift or something like that, I wouldn't be too ashamed to throw that out, a link to my wife, and say, you know, I really like this. This is different. Because sometimes it's hard to figure out what you want as an adult. So there's a lot of opportunity with just unique items, like in a little niche thing like that.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the strong selling points of my whole product line from day one has been that it appeals to men. And when I first started selling to retail stores, when I was wholesaling to retail stores, and I was meeting my buyers at trade shows or talking to them on the phone when they were placing orders, they said, you know, your products are the only thing in the store that gets the guys out of the boyfriend chair.
Oh, yeah.
Because a lot of these gift shops, they would have like a spot for the guys to sit while their girlfriends or wives went shopping. And they said, but, you know, this is the product, you know, a guy will pick up your clock or a bowl or a set of coasters and go, honey, look at this. And, you know, to your point, the appeal to men was sort of like, oh, okay, here's something I'd actually think was cool. And, you know, as the years went on and the man cave became popular and guys were like building their, you know, basement bars or turning the garage into a place to hang out, I was definitely hearing a lot of, yeah, I got one of your clocks in my man cave. It's, you know, proudly displayed on the wall. So that wasn't necessarily my intention when I started designing these products, but, you know, they hit a lot of touch points. They're recycled, they're handmade, they're made in the United States. They're made out of a material that almost anybody can relate to and has some experience with, you know, your first record or memories of being a kid and having vinyl records and lying on the floor, listening to a record, staring at the album cover, reading the liner notes. There's so much memory and nostalgia that is inherent in the material. And I mean, this harkens back a little bit to my time at RISD when I was studying and kind of had to justify the design work I was doing. You know, objects have meaning. Objects hold meaning for people. Mm-hmm. And what I stumbled upon was a ubiquitous object, the record, that almost everyone had some kind of familiarity and relationship with. And then the music that was on the record was what made it personal and specific to your life and to the life you shared with your friends. And so, you know, if someone sees a clock that I'd made and it's Neil Young's Harvest album, and that was their, you know, all time favorite album for when they were 17
I'm gonna need
or
that.
18.
I'm going to need that one.
I mean, you have to, I mean, at that point, it's like the cost doesn't even matter, you know, within reason.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because if that was an $80 clock or a $50 clock, you know, you're like, that's my clock. I have to have that. And what I discovered early on was to stay out of the way of people's connection with their music or present it in a way that really lets someone kind of connect with that object. So if it's a clock, if it's a bowl, if it's a journal, but it's, you know, that label that Neil Young is on, Reprise, or remembering, you know, what the Warner label looked like, or, you know, Columbia, they're iconic pieces of American history, really world history. Mm-hmm. But if we're sticking with American labels, you know, the way the Motown label looks, it's just instantly recognizable with that map of Detroit and the Motown logo in the rainbow font and the purple below. And it's like, you know, when people see it, there's like, oh man, we used to listen to that Four Tops album like crazy when I was a kid. So I'm just kind of like representing records for people with a new use. So I've turned it into a journal. I've made a set of coasters. I've made a clock. It's a bottle opener. But it's like people are buying the record rather than buying the clock. It almost feels like they're buying the record again.
Yeah.
You know, and I almost wish this would be nearly impossible, but I wish there was some way to, you know, include a download code. Like, oh, you just bought a you know, Bob Dylan bottle opener from me, and here's the MP3 that goes along with the record it was made out of. Because I do believe that that's what people are attracted to.
Right. It's obviously you have a lot of passion for what you make, and you love the records. Whenever you pick a wholesale or a retailer to kind of wholesale your products to, how do you go about choosing them? And do you ever come across people that you think, you know, maybe your business isn't a fit for what I do, even though they want to carry it?
So we sell our products on our wholesale platforms by genre. So we understand what we can get our hands on, and we understand what the general public is interested in, which by and large are compatible, right? Because the records that I have access to are used collections of records that were owned by the American public. So generally what's available to me is what people had sitting around in their homes and had purchased. If I could get nothing but Beatles and Stones and Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd records, that would be amazing. Probably could have retired by now. But, you know, we get a lot of Neil Diamond and Barbara Streisand. And, we get a lot of Reader's Digest sets from the 50s and 60s because they had these kind of subscription services.
I imagine you have a lot of the Osmonds. It seems like when I was growing up, my stepdad, he had a big record collection, and I just remember going through and like Osmonds. I don't know if that was just him.
Yeah, there's a lot of Osmonds records. There's a lot of Partridge Family records. There's a lot of Monkees.
I know which clock I'm getting you, Adam. Yeah. It's Osmonds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna save my Osmonds records for you from now on.
They're not all bad.
But it's interesting. I can usually predict what's gonna be in a box of records, especially if someone has just come by my shop and donated. Saturday Night Fever soundtrack's gonna be in there, Carole King's Tapestry will be in there, Show Tune, Sound of Music, and
just a few Herb Alpert's.
The Herb Alpert record collection will be in there. And then there's usually a handful of Christmas records. And then, the weird ones that no one ever listened to that are in like perfect shape, like Hawaiian slack key guitar and, the stuff that came like from the TV, you know, people used to buy records from TV ads and they were usually pretty bad, but the ads were compelling enough for people to buy them.
I guess you light up whenever you see, like you open up and you see, you know, Beatles, Rubber Soul, or you just more obscure from famous bands.
I have a series of collectors and distributors and record shop owners that I buy my records from. I've had to say this as a caveat for almost 20 years now, but in general, we use records that are no longer really playable or collectible or certainly not sellable from a store's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Either they're scratched or the covers are missing or they were left in the sun and they got a little warped or there's a skip in them. So usually they're past their playing prime. So I have a series of people that I buy my records from, and I can say, hey, I need, you know, like 300 to 400 good rock and roll records if you have them, and we could use like a couple hundred country records. And they're always looking. One of the things I discovered early on was that Vinylux provides a great opportunity to the people that I buy records from, because it freed them, the dealers and the collectors, it freed them from having to cherry pick records out of a collection when they were purchasing.
Yeah.
So if someone walked into a record store with, you know, four or five boxes, so let's say 500 records, usually the store owner would have to go through them and say, well, this, let's sell this jazz record for $20 and I'll buy this one from you for a couple bucks. But now the guys that I work with, I say guys because I've never bought a collection ever from a woman for some reason. They're not really into collecting. Well, I know women are into collecting records, but they're not in the trade. They can buy any collection they find because they know that they can pull the 10 or 20 out that they're going to put in their store, and they can sell me the remaining 400 because I can use anything.
Yeah.
So that's been a big part of my business as well. You know, staying true to the notion of this being a recycling endeavor, doing our best to keep any kind of scrap or any kind of material out of the landfill. Certainly if it's a it's a piece of material that I buy, like a record, an album cover, or anything I paid money for, it's like it pains me to throw any part of that in the trash. So I've kept an eye toward designing products that utilize the entire record. The guys I buy the records from now will sleeve them for me, meaning they'll take the jackets off and they recycle them with either, you know, a city municipal recycling program, or they bring them to a recycling plant. And that can be, you know, just recycled like any kind of paper. But the records, I've really focused on all kinds of different ways to use up all the parts. And the very first thing I made that was in attempting to use multiple records in a product was the coaster sets we make, which are composed of six record labels. So we take six records and we cut the centers out just about an eighth of an inch bigger than the original label. And we laminate the label on both sides, and that becomes a coaster. And we sell six of those coasters in a pack. So because originally what happened was I was one of those guys going, oh, I'm going to buy this Beatles record and I'll buy this Stones record from you and I'll buy this whatever. And the shop owners were like, you know, you come in here every week and you cherry pick the dollar bin. Why don't you just take the whole thing? Instead of paying a buck a piece, we'll just give them to you for like 10 cents and you can buy all 1,000 of them. So when I started seeing like the sort of availability of the material and the kind of urgency of the people who were selling them to sell them to me in bulk, it meant that I had to design products that would utilize these bulk collections. And so the coasters became one. But then, of course, once I removed the coaster from the middle of the vinyl, then I had this kind of ring of black vinyl with no label on it. So the challenge then was like, OK, what can we do with that? So I turned that portion of the record into a picture frame that you can put a 5-inch by 5-inch photograph behind. And then it's kind of framed by the circle, the negative space that was cut out and left by the coaster.
I think that's, and then there was, that's important for our listeners to kind of pick up on, I think, is you saw an abundance of a certain kind of supply and you sort of shaped what you produced out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always sort of thought of my business in terms of the aligning with the way a kitchen is run, a commercial kitchen, a restaurant kitchen. And, you know, you've got a certain amount of ingredients that you buy. And if you've bought, you know, a head of broccoli or a box of broccoli, and you know that your customers really only want to eat the florets on the top, you've still got this, you know, hunk of stem that you've paid for. You know, most commercial kitchens will use that in some other product. They'll puree it and turn it into a soup. They'll boil it down into stock. But the last thing a, you know, an executive chef or a restaurant owner ever wants to see is like food they've paid for in the trash. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how I feel about it. Plus I have a mission as a environmentally conscious business to not do that with the material that I've bought. You know, sort of utilizing the design skills I have and the sort of creative thinking, you know, I'm always trying to come up with not only the next product that my clients and customers will be interested in purchasing, but also a product that makes sense in terms of utilizing the scrap material that we've generated, or, you know, figuring out some way to make sure we incorporate pieces and parts of the records into the products. And maybe a good example would be when I designed the clock that we were talking about, the 12-inch clock. Initially, it was molded. The numbers were molded into the vinyl as if they had been pressed into it. But then eventually, when we got into laser cutting the numbers, I was using the remaining portion of the vinyl from the coasters. So we call them donuts, where we've taken the coaster, the label portion out of the center, and we end up with kind of a donut of black vinyl. That's what we use for the back of our clocks. Because I had to use something, and if it wasn't a record, it was going to be a piece of material that I would have to cut to the same size as a record. And mm-hmm. it was just kind of a natural fit. And it was like, you know, we had so many of them lying around, that it just, it made perfect sense to utilize it in another product.
Yeah.
And we do that with our keychains. We do that with our bottle openers. We do that with our record frames. A couple of other items we make as well. So we just have boxes and boxes, and, you know, we store records in milk crates in my shop, and we probably have, 30 or 40 crates full of records at any given time, and about 50 boxes of the donuts, at any given time, which would equate to about 20,000 to 25,000 records.
Yeah.
Wow. In house. Yeah.
So you
talk- and I have a decent collection to listen to now too, as a result of all this.
Yeah. I'd say you found a few gems in there.
Yeah.
So now, you know, when you're talking about the wholesale business, how do all these organizations use your products for advertising and promotion?
So, this is the second, kind of business venture that I launched about 6 years ago. Which is how you found me. And that's the business we call Record Remix. And that's the promotional products and marketing products division of Vinylux. Over the years, I had been contacted, to me out of the blue, but I guess someone who worked at a marketing agency or, a promotional products distributor had been given one of my products as a birthday gift or a Christmas gift and thought, wow, if I could, you know, put a Google logo on the back of this or, you know, brand this for Microsoft, this would be a really cool corporate incentive or a premium. And over the years, I had gotten calls from various agencies saying, you know, could you do a custom printed record label on one of your coasters or a bowl? And as I was going over the books with my bookkeeper one year, she said, you know, every time you get one of these jobs where someone asks for a custom imprint on a record label, or a logo on one of your clocks, you know, the jobs are like, the order sizes are like 10 times the volume what we're used to. And your cost of goods sold is reduced because there's so much more efficiency in volume. And also, you're not going out and sourcing like Beatles and Stones records. You can use, you know, the Reader's Digest box set collection of cowboy songs that no one wants to listen to, and you can paste over the label, so it's like reducing your costs globally.
Yeah.
While increasing your order volume. And I said, yeah, I mean, I love those orders. They're great for production, because my production facility is where my office is. I own a 5,000 square foot building where we make everything that we sell. Or at least we touch everything we sell and assemble everything we sell and decorate everything we sell in my workshop.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really large space.
It's great. I mean, I've had a number of spaces over the years, but this one I found about 12 years ago and was lucky enough to be able to acquire the building next door about 6 months ago. So we've got a good little basis of operations. Philadelphia has proven to be a nice place to run a small scale manufacturing business. But in terms of the promotional pieces, you know, she said every time you get one of these orders, it's like, you know, the profit margin's up and the volume's up and it stabilizes production. How do you get more of those? So I started asking around and I said, you know, who are these people? Like, who's buying t-shirts for Coca-Cola? And who's buying like little, you know, radios that have like a Castrol logo on them? Like, where is this happening? And a friend of mine said, you know, I think there's this industry called ASI, you might look them up. And it turns out they're right here in Pennsylvania. I had never heard of them. And I just started doing my research and my homework. I called ASI. I asked them to introduce the industry to me. And I was invited to go visit a show, a trade show. I had been doing trade shows like New York International Gift Show. I had been doing the Atlanta and Dallas markets. I had done a show, a gift market out in California, but those were strictly wholesale shows for retail buyers. Mm-hmm. And the only like sort of real branding I had ever done was, kind of designing for a specific client was I had made some product for Barnes and Noble years ago for the, I think it was the 50th, maybe it was the 40th anniversary of Woodstock. It was some big Woodstock anniversary. And they asked me to procure licensing rights for Woodstock imagery and to make coasters, record coasters with that were branded Woodstock. And we got a license from the agency that was handling their intellectual property. But this came directly from Barnes & Noble. It wasn't like through a promotional products distributor. So I started trying to figure out this promotional products and marketing industry and joined ASI and then joined PPAI and just had a ton of conversations with the people that I meet at the shows, both distributors and other suppliers, and discussing it's a different industry completely. Even the jargon is different.
Yeah.
In the wholesale world, you've got wholesale pricing, you've got retail pricing. In the promotional world, you've got net pricing and list pricing. You've got, is this coded on a C or is this coded on an R? I didn't even know how to answer the questions at my first ASI show. I was like, what do you mean C and R?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? And the distributors were like, are you new in this industry? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, you need to figure this out.
Yeah.
Because this is how people are communicating with each other in this industry. And I mean,
yeah,
I had
Boris
to put a
didn't tell you
in.
That.
Come on, Boris.
No.
What kind of foresight
he didn't
did you
know.
Have?
Right. So, and I did this with my assistant, Amy at the time, who's now our national sales manager and customer service manager. I was having to communicate this to her, like, hey, if someone calls and they say, I'm requesting, coded list pricing for your record coasters, this is what it means. And so we've kind of had to self-educate in this industry.
Mm-hmm.
But I have always had the belief that it's okay to not know the answer to a question. And it's perfectly fine to ask a question, even if it's the most obvious thing in the world. And, since this is sort of like a podcast about, lending what I've learned in the 20 years of running my business. If you don't know something, just ask. Like, don't pretend you know it. And in fact, even if you think you know it, you should still ask just to verify that. And I'm still learning. I mean, we about 5 years ago at a promotional product show, we were handing out catalogs with net pricing in them. Because I was just assuming that the catalogs were strictly for the distributors at the show. And they would take them back to their showrooms and they would look at our catalog. And I wanted them to know what they were going to be paying me to buy the products. And someone at the show was flipping through the catalog and said, okay, so these are my client costs, right? Printed in your catalog. And I said, no, this is your cost. And he said, well, then how can I show this catalog to a client? And I said, well, why would you do that? This is for you. And he said, no, the catalogs are really to sell your product to our clients.
Yeah.
And I said, well, don't show them this one or, they're going to know what you're. And he was kind of upset with me. And I said, look, no one's told me the rules. I'm just trying to, do the best I can here. And I would say to this day, that particular aspect of how to market our products is still a little bit of a. There's so many hoops to jump through and so many kind of smoke screens and hurdles to put up,
Yeah.
Okay, Jeff, just before we wrap up here, I do have a couple kind of odd and strange questions, just kind of for fun. But I noticed on your website that you do custom products. Do you have any funny stories or of strange requests you might have received from a customer?
Oh, man. Off the top of my head, strange requests. They're all kind of strange in a way.
Yeah.
Everybody's got a weirdness to them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the custom work is actually the thing I like the best and the thing that I'm kind of leaning into the most right now. You know, I was doing, I don't know if anything was ever like super strange. I was doing a campaign a couple years ago for a cannabis company that, you know, when pot became legal in Canada, you know, retail packaging and point of sale displays and all that are like critical because it, you know, kind of weed is weed. And because it's legal, it's like there's this gold rush now to be the sort of chief, you know, the most recognizable brand. Mm-hmm. So this company came to me and wanted to do some design work that kind of utilized records and cassettes and 8-tracks from the 70s because they have this kind of like, you know, California 70s vibe to their brand. And that was kind of interesting, you know, sort of combining like weed culture and music culture and, you know, like music. And that was kind of a fun, interesting project to work on.
So what about, you know, one thing that we like to talk about is failures to some degree. So have you had a product that flopped or made a mistake that you feel comfortable sharing?
Yeah. I mean, the best product I've ever designed, I think, are the most interesting and most well-developed and most forward-thinking product I've ever designed was kind of a flop, unfortunately. And you know, you never really know why exactly, but I had a great opportunity from one of my retailers, which is a company called Uncommon Goods. And they run a very large website operation and mail order catalog. But they're very maker forward. You know, they support independent artists. They support independent design companies and, you know, have been strong proponents of the DIY maker movement. And we're kind of right there at the beginning of Vinylux. We formed a partnership like almost 20 years ago and in a way helped each other define our brands. You know, they consider the Vinylux line an important mainstay of their product offering. And I absolutely consider them one of our most important customers. And about, I don't know, maybe this is 5 years ago now, they came to me, the owner of the company, whom I've known for a long time, said, you know, we have an interesting partnership going with Kickstarter. And we're looking for product to launch a Kickstarter campaign with. And Kickstarter came to Uncommon Goods because they knew that Uncommon Goods had a strong community of artists and designers and makers. And Uncommon Goods was interested in Kickstarter because they have such a massive marketing engine. And the partnership seemed symbiotic and like a good idea for everybody. So the owner of Uncommon Goods said to me, you know, has there ever been a product that you've been dying to make and you just don't have the resources, the time, the energy, the money, the know-how that, you know, maybe we could help you. We could partner with you and kind of bring something to life. So I said, yeah, you know, at the time I was manufacturing and I no longer make, I was making a little guitar amp. I'm a guitar player. I've been playing since I was 9 years old. And I had a kid working for me who knew how to like hack transistor radio circuit boards and turn them into like little amplifiers. And he would take like cheap little speakers and wire them and like, you know, plug his guitar into it and make them sound like these dirty, grungy, like really cool little amps. Hmm. And I said, you know, do you know how to do this? Like, could you make like a new circuit board? You know, do you know how to design them? And he said, yeah, I mean, there's plans online. So we started manufacturing this little guitar amp and it was cool, but it was a hard sell. Mm-hmm. Because gift shops aren't really where musicians go to buy gear. And, you know, so like a a person might buy one as a gift for a friend, but they were kind of expensive and they just didn't sell that well. But they were selling okay, and I was at a trade show with the owner of Uncommon Goods, and I said, you know, if that guitar amp was a Bluetooth speaker that someone could connect their phone to, I think it would be a much, much more successful product than the amp. And he said, yeah, I agree with you. Do you have a design in mind? Do you have? And I said, no, I mean, I'd have to figure out how to deal with Bluetooth and all of that. And he said, well, I like this idea and I'm willing to back it if this is the one that you think you want to start working on. And we'll do it for this Kickstarter campaign. And it took about a year and a half, which is, you know, the longest development I've ever spent, the longest time developing a product I've ever spent. But, you know, once we kind of figured out what the thing wanted to look like and how it wanted to, you know, be presented to the world, like it was a wooden cabinet and I kind of utilized the shape of one of my record bowls as the horn of the speaker, kind of reminiscent of an old gramophone speaker. You know, I kind of put this thing together, I cobbled it together and I took a Bluetooth speaker apart, kind of did, you know, a Frankenstein mock-up, and it sounded terrible. And I was like, why doesn't this, you know, this is really frustrating. Like, why, how come you can buy like a little $10 Bluetooth speaker at Staples that's like the size of a half a Coke can and it sounds pretty good, and this thing sounds terrible? And I said, I'm a little bit stuck, but because they had resources for this product development, they hired a audio engineer who was based here in Philadelphia, and he came to my studio and he worked with me for like 8 hours one day, kind of breaking down the components of a speaker and the architecture of a speaker and how the airflow needs to move. And it's like kind of all related to the size of the driver that you're using. The driver is the actual little speaker that makes the sound.
Yeah.
And then the enclosure is the box that the driver goes into, but that's all kind of mathematically calculated. And he showed me websites and how to calculate the formulas. And I got to work and I spent months, you know, kind of prototyping these and building different size boxes and different shapes. And eventually we got the thing sounding really good. Not great, but really good. And the owner of Uncommon Goods said, you know, here's where I'd like you to get this. I want you to get it sounding as good as a JBL Flip 5, because that's like a $125 Bluetooth speaker. And we want to sell this thing for around $150. And if it can sound as good as one of those, we think we'll be well positioned. And, you know, eventually we did it. We got this thing with like good bass response and a nice clear tone, and it was good and loud. We found a company to manufacture us a semi-custom Bluetooth board that when you connect it to your phone, it said Vintage Vinyl was the name of the unit, and that would show up on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like soldering up you know, toggle switches and volume knobs, and I hired someone to kind of be my speaker builder in-house. You asked me about a product that failed, and the reason this failed was that one of the reasons was that the cabinet that I designed, although I thought it was a fairly straightforward wooden enclosure, had a bent wood top, laminated wood, so it was rounded on top, so it would kind of mimic the shape of the back of the bowl, the horn of the speaker. And I found a company that said, yeah, we can do that, no problem. And they were here in Philadelphia, and it took them like 9 months to make the first round of cabinets before we even got to like assemble or build anything. And the Kickstarter campaign had already launched, and I think people are starting to get frustrated that it was taking so long to get the product. And, you know, I think sometimes when you're working on a new product, momentum is everything, because you're pouring your energy into it and you're pouring your creative juices into the thing, and their partners are excited, and their Uncommon Goods is working on the branding, and Kickstarter was dealing with the campaign. But getting them out the door proved to be just a terribly slow process.
Yeah,
yeah, well, it's too bad, because it sounds like a really, really cool idea.
It's a really cool product, and I'm hoping to relaunch it someday. It's a very, very complex product to make. I think we had to stock like 65 different components just for this one product. And, you know, each one of them took well over an hour to assemble. We had specialized packaging made for it, and it's like a 7-part corrugated cardboard box. You know, there's like trays and wraps and, you know, when you buy a computer, it comes in molded styrofoam, and it's like 2 parts, and it squeezes the thing, and you just throw it in a box, and you're done.
Well, I'm going to keep up with you, because I'm curious to see how that goes in the future, because I'd like to get on your website in a few years and see that on there. I don't play the guitar, but that'd be a good reason to buy a guitar and get a cool amp.
Yeah. Well, this one you just play music through from your phone.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, anybody can use it. And the people who have them love them. I mean, I people reach out and they say, well, you know, this is a piece of art that happens to also function as a speaker.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great. But I think because of that, maybe even like it was a piece of art that functions as a speaker, it's a little like, well, it's fragile and it's kind of hard to move. And, you know, you got to find the right spot for it. It's not for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how would our listeners find your website and see your products online?
So our retail website is www.vinylux.net. And Vinylux is the word vinyl, V-I-N-Y-L, with a U-X on the end of it, .net. And if you happen to be in the promotional products or custom product market, we also operate recordremix.com. And that's for custom branded promotional items made from vinyl records. A similar product line, but instead of using the original Bob Dylan or Motown labels, it's where you can put your own brand and artwork onto the record label.
And I can definitely help them navigate that.
Great.
So,
All right. Well, Jeff, we really appreciate you coming on and talking with us. I feel like you've got a lot of good things that you've shared. They could be really picked up and used by other business leaders. Do you have any last nuggets of advice that you might pass on to someone who has a dream to turn a cool idea into a business?
I would say surround yourself with knowledgeable people, interesting people who you can share your ideas with and get advice from. You know, don't keep it to yourself, because it's just amazing how much experience other people have. And you know, it's the same reason you might be listening to this podcast in the first place. It's just, that's been my biggest asset, you know, partnerships with vendors, partnerships with suppliers, you know, great relationships with people who have expertise other than your own, right? I think everybody starts a business because you've got something that you're good at, right? I was good at creating objects from weird, funky materials. But I'm not so great at bookkeeping, and I'm not so great at accounting and marketing and sales. So, you know, when you start a small business, it's like you kind of have to do everything yourself. But once you get a little bit of traction, or even maybe you can barter right at the beginning, like get a good bookkeeper. You know, have someone paying attention to the money. Yeah, I guess just, you know, ask lots of questions and you know, be nice, be kind. It goes a long way. That's helped too.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I think that's a great message for our audience. And I certainly appreciate you being here. Had a great conversation. Jeff Davis, Vinylux Record Remix, I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, it was fun. Take care.
As we wrap up today's show, I want to give a huge shout out to our guest for joining us today. It's another great conversation with another amazing small business leader. I hope you guys got a ton of value out of that. In the show notes are links to social media accounts that we talked about. I would encourage you guys to click those, follow those, and engage with our guests that all of them. They love connecting with other small business leaders. That's why they're here. So I don't encourage you to do that. Also, and unfortunately, this show is not free to produce. And if you would like to help support the show, we would be forever grateful. There's actually an easy link to click where you can buy us a cup of coffee. Just sending a few dollars our way to help support the show would mean so much to us and would go a long way. Again, thank you guys so much for joining us. And until next time on the Humans Doing Business podcast, we will see you soon.